Got your attention yet? Just how closely are Texans tracking the impeachment story and whether it'll move the political needle in the Lone Star State? That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Among the other stories, we're following the state of solitary confinement in Texas, where more than 1,300 prisoners have been held for 6 years or more. Also, a new fight over phone encryption and consumer expectations of privacy. Plus, the rediscovery of a Texas baseball team whose story was nearly lost with the end of the era of sports segregation. All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 23rd day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. We say it often, but not enough. We're so grateful to have you join us, and it's always great to hear from you, too. Tell us what's making news today in your part of Texas. Just tweet us at Texas Standard or look us up on your social media platform of choice. Big story unfolding as we speak. You may recall that 8 years back, after Texas barred Planned Parenthood from a state program called Healthy Texas Women, the Obama administration cut off federal Medicaid money to Texas. Well, in a reversal of that policy, the Trump administration has agreed to restore as much as $350 million in funding to Texas. Governor Abbott's calling this a victory for women's health. Critics say this will only offset state dollars without adding to women's health services. Underlying the back and forth is the politics of abortion and Planned Parenthood. The Texas Standard News Desk is taking a closer look. We're expecting more at the bottom of the hour. There are plenty of folks who will tell you that the phrase Texas justice is an oxymoron. Well, that may be cynical, but it comes from the state's reputation with matters such as conditions in the state's prisons, where solitary confinement is far from uncommon. There's a growing consensus among mental health experts and corrections officials that solitary is not just expensive, but also harmful for inmate staff, indeed the communities those inmates may return to. In fact, the psychological distress that's been connected with long periods of solitary confinement are so well established that the United Nations considers solitary beyond 15 days to be torture. Yet at last count, more than 1,300 prisoners in the Texas prison system have been held for 6 years or more, some up to 2 decades, including some folks who are eligible for parole. Now, if this sounds somewhat incomprehensible, wait till you read the story by Michael Barajas for the Texas Observer on the prison inside prison. Michael, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
It's a moving and very disturbing story that you paint here. As I understand it, the sheer size of the Texas prison system, the largest of any state, you're going to expect to find more people in solitary, but I think a lot of people wonder, how do you get there in the first place?
That's right. As I detail in the story, there are a number of routes into solitary. It could be because of serious, you know, disciplinary reasons. Somebody could have been found with a makeshift weapon in their cell. They could have been implicated in some serious prison violence or something of that nature, and that's, you know, was their route into solitary. For others, it could be because of an allegation of gang affiliation, and that's been one of the main tools that the Texas prison system has used to keep violence at pretty low levels compared to other big prison states.
You go back to the 1980s when there were some serious problems in the prison system. There was unrest, riots, deaths, homicides in prison, and this was when that this administrative confinement, I know there are tons of euphemisms for solitary confinement, but it really started being used to a much larger degree than before.
The period that you referenced, the 1980s, is really a period of great change and real challenges for the Texas prison system. At one end, you had the civil rights movement that had kind of finally reached the prison house doors, and conditions of confinement were finally being challenged seriously in the court system. And the courts were listening in Texas, and once reforms were implemented, and it depends on who you ask, but really the Texas prison system at the time, sort of balking at some of those reforms. Essentially, the guard staff was never hired to really manage for all the people that were being put behind bars. And so as one of the tools to really reduce the violence that started to kind of start screaming to the surface, this new method of supermax confinement was really leaned on heavily by the prison system.
But there are people who were put in solitary back in the 80s who are still there, right?
Right. Like I profiled one of the men. His name is Benito Alonso. He's one of, I believe it's 18 at last count. people who are held, who have been held in solitary confinement for 30 years or longer. He's been 33 years.
What are the conditions like inside? Were you able to get inside and see?
No, that's one of the big challenges for me, or I think anybody reporting on prisons conditions in general at the moment, is just getting access to some of the conditions that you're writing about. I mean, you can Google, you can see pictures that people have taken of solitary confinement cells in Texas and elsewhere. You know, despite months of requests, the Texas prison system wouldn't allow me inside to view any of the cells. You know, I was able to visit several men, as I document in the story. You know, they're basically brought out into a cage, unshackled, and then I get to talk to them behind a plexiglass
screen. And one of
them
actually drew pictures of the condition.
Yeah. So one of the guys I corresponded to for a while, he's been in solitary for nearly 2 decades. He is a really talented artist, turns out. I've been writing to a lot of these guys for months, and so I was telling him how frustrated I was because they wouldn't let me see the conditions they were in. And he started sending me really detailed sketches of what the three different types of solitary cells he's lived in over those nearly 2 decades, what they look like. And you can see that in the story. They're pretty detailed and pretty stunning, actually, when you consider living inside those conditions.
I want to tell you, they're stark. But I think someone who might be thinking, well, think about the victims. Think about the people who were injured or harmed, otherwise harmed by some of these inmates. But I want to understand, why is it that people should feel some compassion for those who have been thrown into the hole, as they call it, in prison?
Well, I mean, I think for one thing, just like the premise of that question, I think there's a misunderstanding of who is even in prison sometimes and who ends up in these circumstances. I mean, some of the men I write about have been convicted of murder. Others are in prison for much lesser offenses. You know, the guy that I just talked about who has been in solitary for nearly 2 decades, I mean, he ended up in prison as a teenager. Initially, he was picked up for, you know, some stupid, you know, robberies, and then he tried to escape, and then one thing led to another, and now he claims there's no pathway out of solitary confinement for somebody like him. I mean, yes, there are people for whom the victims are pretty easily identifiable, and the harm that was caused on that end is clear, but I mean, still, we're talking about something that, like, a growing consensus of medical and mental health professionals consider torture. And a lot of the reason, you know, the experts that I talk to will kind of lean away from that word isn't because it's not warranted. It's just because they're afraid it might be alienating to corrections officials.
Well, then let's just use plain language. What is it that these individuals are experiencing as a result of the conditions of solitary confinement?
Yeah. And I want to be clear, you know, I focus in the story on 6 years plus because that's where Texas is the clear leader. You know, as we did, it's more than long-term solitary confinement, which is a term experts say almost guaranteed to cause serious psychological damage. You know, 6 years plus is kind of an arbitrary distinction, but that's what's counted right now. But, you know, research shows that even after a few days in this type of isolation can trigger serious psychosis in people, especially if there's already some, you know, latent proclivity to mental illness, or, you know, some brain scans have shown signs of, like, delirium and stupor within just a few days. Once you get toward the longer end, I mean, you find people that are completely either detached from reality, or, you know, the ones that have been able to sort of keep it together and, you know, communicate with me some of these thoughts. I mean, they pretty regularly have delusions that test their grip on reality. They experience hallucinations on a pretty regular basis. They have thoughts of suicide, self-harm. I mean, the effects are very well documented is the thing. That's why, I mean, torture is a really extreme word, but I think that's why it's used.
Well, I want to ask about the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's response to this, because you reached out to them in addition to asking to see the inside of some of these facilities and getting turned down. They did say that they consider themselves a leader in reform. And in fact, there has been this move away from solitary confinement among many states, right?
Yeah, to give them full credit, Texas has made strides. And over the course of a decade, nearly dropping, you know, from 9,000 to about 4,500 at last count in solitary. It's also, because of the opacity of the system, kind of difficult to judge exactly what that means. Still, when we're talking about one of the most extreme practices that the prison system has to offer, Texas is, I mean, by any measure, implementing one of the most extreme versions of it when we look at long-term solitary. And it's people with loved ones in long-term solitary that I hear from, that inmate family association groups hear from, that just, like, feel that they have nowhere else to turn inside the prison system when they see them languishing after that amount of time in isolation.
Is there no independent oversight to the way that solitary confinement is used in Texas prisons?
There is an internal system that the prison system uses.
An internal
classification system. Right. I kind of think of it as a game of administrative hot potato where nobody really wants to make the decision to let somebody that may have had a serious security concern 20 years ago out now that they're, you know, elderly or need a wheelchair or a walker to get around. I mean, those systems, at least in isolated cases, appear to be not working for certain people. You know, I've written before about family members who saw a loved one really just sort of losing it in solitary and felt they had nowhere else to turn, went through the grievance process, wrote officials, and still the loved one was never pulled out of the hole and committed suicide.
That sounds like there's no way out then. I mean, is there anything that lawmakers could be doing, have tried to do, but failed to do?
I think it boils down to that oversight question. You know, part of the reason I even ended up writing about solitary to this extent is it's one of the concerns that I keep hearing from inmate family groups and, you know, people with loved ones inside about extreme and dehumanizing practices inside the prison system that continue, that, you know, they complain about but feel those internal grievance, you know, processes aren't working. That's why they keep going to the legislature every session and asking for a system of independent oversight, something akin to what the juvenile justice system did in Texas about a decade ago, after a series of scandals there really focused lawmakers' attention on the conditions behind bars and juvenile prisons. Solitary is one of those things that I keep hearing brought up as, you know, one of the screaming examples of why that kind of oversight needs to be implemented over the adult prison system as well.
It is a stirring report, The Prison Inside Prison, Solitary Confinement in Texas. Read all about it in the texasobserver.org. We'll link to it at texasstandard.org. And Michael Barajas is the author. Michael, thanks so much for stopping by our studios. Good to see you, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Texas, now let's hear from you. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from several folks about solitary confinement in Texas. On our Facebook page, Kim Nahara asks, how does this help an inmate? Long-term isolation makes inmates with mental issues more unstable. She says violent offenders may need more supervision, but locking someone up and leaving them there is so medieval. And Isabella Wojcik calls the practice of solitary confinement abuse. Besides that, she points out other countries have a system which actually rehabilitates inmates and they have low prisoner comeback. That means our system is the way that our politicians want it, which means we should change politicians. Well, speaking of politics, we're also hearing about the ongoing impeachment trial in the United States Senate, plus an interesting statement closer to home from Governor Greg Abbott. The governor says to Californians mulling a move to Texas, don't blow it when you come here. Some interesting remarks he made there on Fox Business Channel. We've shared those remarks on Facebook and Twitter. I'll be back with those reactions later in the show.
Let's hear from you. Tweet us or join us on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back in 35 minutes right here on the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. Almost 100 years ago, hemp was legally grown in Texas. Then it was banned in the 1920s. That'll change again this spring. The 2019 Texas legislature made sure of that by passing a bill allowing farmers to grow the non-psychoactive cousin of marijuana for fiber and CBD. Well, since then, the Texas Department of Agriculture has been formulating regulations for the new crop. Farmers had a chance to weigh in on those rules at a public hearing in Waco on Wednesday, and the Texas Standard's own Michael Marks was there.
Although there's no shortage of people in Texas planning to get into the hemp industry, many of them have serious concerns about how it will be regulated. One of the main points of contention is how the plant's THC levels will be tested. If a plant contains more than 0.3% tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, it's considered marijuana and has to be destroyed. Some people, like Kevin Calloway, a tomato farmer from Hondo, think that 0.3% figure is too low. Will cause lots of growers to lose crops and money.
Texas is hot, dry, and windy. All of those are stressors. Hemp produces high THC levels when stressed.
Calloway considered raising hemp, but decided against it. He says it's just too risky under the current rules.
You just can't be a pragmatic farmer and risk taking your farm to the casino.
Others urge the Department of Agriculture to make changes to alleviate backlogs in the system, such as letting farmers apply for licenses as soon as possible and extending the amount of time between harvest and THC testing. Right now, farmers have to harvest their crops within 15 days of testing, which, according to advocates like Candace Dyer of Fort Worth,
that's not enough time. Like they were saying, it takes at least that to just dry it out if it rains.
And with many farmers harvesting around the same time, the state's approved testing labs may also struggle to keep up.
It's going to be backed up, like they said.
Some farmers bemoan the fact that Texas does not have a certified seed program yet, meaning it's harder to verify the quality and composition of seeds before buying them. According to Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller, these comments will help his department draft the final version of the rules.
We had some tweaking and tuning to do. We had some really good comments in there, so, and we'll go through those. Our legal team will go through them, and I think we'll have a good program, so I really appreciate the input.
The rules are available for public comment online until February 10th. Commissioner Miller said he hopes the agency will start issuing licenses to grow hemp by mid-March, so growers don't miss the spring planting season. In Waco, I'm Michael Marks for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Last week, U.S. Attorney General William Barr called on Apple to help the FBI unlock two iPhones belonging to the Saudi military officer who killed three sailors and wounded eight others at Pensacola Naval Air Station in December. It's the latest dust-up between Apple and the feds over access to iPhones linked to people accused of crimes. Apple says not allowing the government a backdoor into that device is critical to protecting its customers' privacy. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to navigate the conflict between Apple and the government for us. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Apple CEO Tim Cook has said privacy is, quoting him, a human right, and has refused to give the government a means to retrieve the contents of its customers' phones. Can you lay out Apple's case for blocking government access? What is it that they say?
Yeah, Apple's case is that if we break an iPhone for this, that opens up everything to hackers, that it kind of destroys the encryption that they've built by creating this backdoor. The thing you're not hearing a lot from the government is that Apple is already giving over a lot of data to the government. Even in this case, they actually did give the iCloud backups to the government for this specific case. They just are not willing to break the phone itself.
I want to loop back on that point because it's an important point. But first, I want to focus on this idea of privacy as a human right. And there are a lot of people who would say, sure, it is. Of course it is. It's a human right. Without giving it a whole lot more thought. But this is a business model for Apple. Forget about the human right aspect of this, because this is what they have built their infrastructure upon, is this assurance that if you buy an iPhone, we're going to protect your data. But as you're pointing out, that's not necessarily the case. They might just keep your phone from getting broken into, right?
Absolutely. And Apple has really tried to stand apart from your Googles and your Amazons by saying, no, we are the company that's going to keep your device most secure.
The device.
Exactly. And as they've updated the iPhones, you know, the iOS 11, 12, 13, each one has gotten tougher on things like jailbreaking and being able to unlock these phones. They keep patching these security holes and making the phones more secure. What is not encrypted or as protected is your backups of your phone on your computer or the ones that go over to iCloud. That gets into a whole other area.
So we're talking about cloud accounts. You can opt in or out of that, though, right? Or your phone allows you to either back up the phone or not, correct?
Yeah, and I think most people assume that these backups are encrypted. If you're backing up to your computer, which some people, I still do that with my iPhone, that backup is not encrypted unless you specifically choose to encrypt it.
So that's a pretty big difference. Now, I want to get back to something, because the government asked Apple for access to a shooter's iPhone before. This is not altogether new, so if there's a little deja vu here, I recall the San Bernardino shooting a few years back.
In 2016, the exact same thing kind of happened. There were a few key differences, and what ended up happening in that case was that the government found another way to unlock the phone using a third party. So Apple didn't budge, but the government found another way around that.
Well, now, if that's the case, can't they do something similar here?
You would think so.
Yeah.
But they have not. And part of the government's case in this is that they say that the shooter shot two phones that were involved in this. older phones, I think an iPhone 7 and an iPhone 5, and they had to reconstruct those phones physically, but apparently even that, they're still not able to get into those phones.
No, wait, let me get this straight. The shooter actually shot, when you say shot the phones, you mean with a bullet?
With a bullet. Yeah. One analyst said, you know, they don't have an Apple problem, they have a bullet problem here.
I see. So, and a pretty important evidentiary issue, too, because this would suggest that there's something on that phone that the shooter does not want the government to see.
And these were not newer phones. These were older models, so they would be more susceptible to breaking in with the third-party software. But apparently the government says that they haven't been able to do that. Although there are some analysts who think the government is just trying to make a point here, trying to kind of put Apple in a position where, with some public pressure and even tweets from the president, to kind of loosen up their security and allow the government a backdoor to these devices.
I want to understand something about Apple's rationale for handing over data from its customers' cloud accounts when authorities present a subpoena. But when it comes to access to the phone, even those that are bullet-riddled, Apple's not going to go there.
Yeah, Apple has said publicly that they do want to, you know, prevent suicides and help with, you know, these investigations and crimes. What they are not willing to do is to break the kind of encryption where even Apple doesn't have a backdoor. When you encrypt something end-to-end, and we can get into that, even Apple does not have a way to break that encryption unless they have your passcode that you set up for that encryption. Even Apple can't do that.
In fact, Reuters reported earlier this week that Apple had planned to offer end-to-end encryption of iCloud accounts, but backed off under pressure from the government, right?
And there's some question about that, too. There's some reporting from Reuters that Apple was planning to do this, was planning to offer end-to-end encryption on the cloud. Mm-hmm. But John Gruber, who is a longtime tech analyst, suggests that he doesn't think it was under pressure from the government. He thinks Apple either just has chosen not to do it, or there were other factors involved. Hmm. He doesn't think that Apple just went to the government and said, hey, guys, we're doing this. What do you think? That's not Apple style at all.
Well, this is a story that Omar Gayaga continues to keep his eye on. He keeps his eye on all tech news over at techminutetexas.com, and you should keep your eyes on him, too. Omar, good to talk with you again. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks. Pleasure as always.
We'll see you next week.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, providing visitors a glimpse into the past on Museum Day, January 25th and 26th, with 11 museums, including Bishop's Palace, the Naval Museum, and Moody Mansion. Details at galvestonmuseumday.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Trump administration is restoring more than $300 million in federal funding to a state family planning program, which lost money under the Obama administration after Texas officials excluded Planned Parenthood. KUT's Ashley Lopez has more.
Healthy Texas Women is a program that provides birth control, cancer screenings, and basic women's health care to low-income Texans, particularly women. The problem is that when they kicked out Planned Parenthood, they kicked out a provider that was called a high-capacity provider, like was built to serve a lot of people, and it exists in a lot of places. So there has been, in the past several years, coverage deserts, holes in their map of who's serving and how many people they can serve. So the Trump administration is setting a new precedent by saying, yes, it is okay to, for ideological reasons, kick out a certain provider, and we will still fund that program using Medicaid funds.
Ashley Lopez reporting. The city of Laredo is pushing back against the Trump administration's efforts to build a barrier between the U.S. and Mexico along its riverfront. Council members voted overwhelmingly this week to deny a federal request for surveyors to access about 13 miles of city land. Julia Wallace is covering the story for the Laredo Morning Times. She says many community members have strong feelings about walling off the river.
Laredo was founded in 1755. That was before the United States became a country. And we were founded along the banks of the Rio Grande. So this just feels like, to many people, I think, very personal, because it is such a personal, physical thing.
Wallace says the Justice Department is planning to sue the city to get access to the riverfront. A Republican congressman from Texas says conservatives cannot completely ignore climate change. U.S. Representative Dan Crenshaw of Houston spoke Wednesday at an event hosted by the right-leaning Texas Public Policy Foundation. Still, Crenshaw criticized Democrats for being alarmist when it comes to environmental issues.
That doesn't mean there isn't some effect on the climate from man-made emissions. And we could admit that and say, okay, well, we all have an interest in cleaner air and cleaner water and generally lowering emissions, because even if we don't know what it's doing to the environment, well, let's at least err on the side of caution. But it doesn't mean erring on the side of destroying our economy, which is what the left would have.
Crenshaw is backing a proposal in the works from top Republicans in the U.S. House to address climate change. It includes capturing carbon dioxide emissions and clean energy innovation. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Project Innovate, inviting photographers of all levels to share their unique perspective of Texas. Top submissions will be showcased at the Dell Experience at South by Southwest. Details at projectinnovate.com/Texas.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. You know, it's not hard to find almost any historical detail about the Wichita Falls Sputters Baseball Club. Just try Googling them. You'll confirm all manner of trivia. For instance, that the Sputters won the Texas League in 1927. That in 1949, Sputters outfielder Frank Saucier led all of baseball with a .446 batting average. And that the team still plays in the Pecos League, an independent minor league. Such details about the Wichita Falls Black Sputters, however, are quite scarce indeed. They were a baseball team too, but they played in the Texas Negro League, formed 100 years ago when baseball was still segregated. Information or stories about that club are quite hard to find, but that hasn't stopped people from looking. In fact, the search is part of a new exhibit at the Museum of North Texas History in Wichita Falls. Here to tell us more is Margie Reese. She is the executive director of the Wichita Falls Alliance for Arts and Culture. Margie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start with what we do know about the Black Sputters. Tell us a little bit about them.
So the Black Sputters of Wichita Falls played here, you know, in the 20s, mm-hmm. and they were just like every other team that was organized informally or formally by African-American players around that time. But they were organized to play in a league mostly around the state of Texas.
We should probably point out to people who don't know the term sputters. I certainly didn't until now. Apparently, a sputter is not a potato farmer, but actually it comes from the oil field. Someone who sets up and operates a well drilling machine. So that's where you get the sputters and the black sputters from. So as you did a little bit of drilling down yourself, did you find anyone with information on the black sputters? I mean, are there photos out there? Are there people with relatives still around willing to talk? Or what did you discover?
Right. So just learning about the Sputters team, the baseball team that you talked about, the white team, I also learned that there was a black team. And this preceded something called the Negro Leagues, right? Because these were Texas teams that were being organized, self-organized. So the Black Sputters then became part of the Texas League, as I said, and that's where my curiosity started. I couldn't control myself. So the search for the Sputters led me to talk to a few gentlemen who still live in Wichita Falls, who could tell me about their memory and understanding about the original team.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second wave of Sputters that came about later, I have been fortunate to interview a couple of gentlemen who actually played during that time. And their stories are just as provocative and compelling as you imagine.
Could you share maybe a bit of a story with us so we get a sense of, I mean, something that was particularly memorable?
Yeah, this one kind of struck at the core of it all. You know, part of what this baseball phenomenon across the country was also about America's favorite pastime and about enjoying the game and having fun. And this group of guys from this part of Texas, the gentleman was telling me as they boarded a bus and had to drive from Wichita Falls area to the Dallas-Fort Worth area through some of the small towns, that they would see black men hanging from trees on their way to play a game and to be as lighthearted as they could be by the time they got to their destination was difficult. They feared for their lives. They couldn't stop at restaurants. They couldn't stop for gas. Their cars couldn't break down. It's kind of like the yin and yang part of the story. The great joy that the sport brought to them as players.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fear and agony that they had to go through to share that So I think for me, I just keep, I'm not looking for the story of the agony, because we can read that in our history books. I'm looking for the stories about perseverance and staying focused. You can imagine those gentlemen that were being cheered by, you know, hundreds of Black people across the state of Texas and across the country. And at the same time, they were despised by their white counterparts. So I think this is a lot. It's a lot of my personal commitment to this. My dad played baseball. I just think for me, it is this sort of quest about how do we stay focused as Americans? How do we look at the Black and whiteness of who we are and still manage to come together and celebrate the things that are important to us, you know, as a democratic society? I mean, that's kind of sounds kind of heavy, but that one story really, really stuck with me about, you know, you're riding along in the evening and you look out and you see what could be your brother. And you're on your way to participate in a celebratory, you know, sporting event.
Margie Reese is the executive director of the Wichita Falls Alliance for Arts and Culture. We're at the Museum of North Texas History in Wichita Falls. There's a new exploration trying to reclaim the story of the Wichita Falls Black Sputters. Margie, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to share that with us. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thank you for asking.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Ever complimented someone's boots and heard a story in response? Happens a lot in these parts, which is why we've dedicated an entire segment to this Texas phenomenon from heel to toe, stories about Texans and their boots. A friend of the Texas Standard calls these stories footnotes. Get it?
My name is John Arthur Martinez, born in Austin, raised in the Texas Hill Country west of Austin in a ranching community called Round Mountain, Texas. And at that time was little more than peach country, ranching country. And I bring all this up is because, you know, that is boot country. And so I've been wearing, you know, ranch wear and ranch attire since I was a kid. And I was a scholarship athlete at the University of Mary Hardin Baylor playing tennis. And I had a terrible knee injury. I had pushed myself and pushed my body, and I had challenged the number one player on the team the previous week, and I had won. And so I had 1 week where I was the top player on my university team, and that was the week my knee gave out. That is just a horrible situation to have for an athlete who all of your life you've been pushing yourself, and you think, okay, I may even try to become a professional tennis player. So what do you do when suddenly you can't pick up the racket because you can't even, you have trouble walking? Well, I turned all of that energy into the guitar and songwriting. This one's called the Cherry Spring Swing. And we don't have the fiddles and the twin guitar, etc. So I'm going to have to emulate that a lot like Ella Fitzgerald. I may have to scat some of it. Oh, yeah. Go west, young man, to Cherry Springs. Fiddler's rule, swing is king. Finest playing for the door, like the Texas troubadour. Walk the floor where E.T. cried the night he heard his child died. Hear a spirit from above the rafters echo faded love. Elvis called a rising star, saw Chuck Berry's red guitar. Hank First and Patsy Cline, Johnny Cash once walked the line. Shine your boots, it's Saturday night, you'll swear Bob Wills is still alive. The German folks still love to sing the Cherry Springs Swing. I can say that I've only played tennis one time in my boots and my hat. And that was because we saw some hot dog kids playing on the court. I remember we were coming back home into Marble Falls and we saw the lights at the courts,
And so we drove by the old courts where I grew up. And I told the bass player as we were traveling and we were passing through these courts at night, I told the bass player that I could beat those kids in my boots. So I got out of the vehicle that we were, probably my old Dodge van at that time. And so I had to go out and school them in my cowboy boots, my hat. And I did school them in my boots and my hat. That's the first time I've ever told that story publicly.
The voice of John Arthur Martinez, a Texas troubadour. So how about you? If we ran into you at the grocery store, what might you tell us about those fine-looking boots? But what if we don't see you at the grocery store? Exactly, that's why you need to drop us a line. Texas Standard at KUT.org. Tell us all about it.
Johnny Cash once walked the line. Shiny boots, it's Saturday night. You'll swear Bob Wills is still alive. The German folks still love to sing the Cherry Spring Swing.
Bob Wills is still alive, for crying out loud. You've heard of the state's anti-litter campaign called Adopt a Highway. Well, down in San Antonio way, they've got their own spin on curbing litter called Adopt a Spot. Some 60 organizations have volunteered to pick up trash along San Antonio's more litter-prone areas to keep debris out of area waterways. Texas Public Radio's Brian Kirkpatrick joined a group of 8th graders on San Antonio's south side to see Adopt a Spot in action.
All right, I want you to separate into groups of four. I'm going to give each group a bag, and then I'm going to give you an area, okay? Who's your group? Keith, who's your group?
That is Dr. Rene Rico, who is supervising his 8th grade communications applications class at Sam Rayburn Middle School. They're picking up trash in an empty field across the street on the southwest side. The class is just one of 60 groups or organizations across the city that have signed up for the city's Adopt a Spot program to remove trash from streets and drainage areas. Their efforts keep trash out of waterways, which is the program's ultimate goal. Rico thinks volunteering his classes for the program have made them a more responsible part of their society and better communicators, which is part of the course curriculum. Does Rico think his 8th graders are ready to put down their smartphones and leave their air-conditioned classroom to pick up trash?
Of course, the initial reaction was, why am I picking up trash, right? I don't even do that at home. But once we were out there, and, you know, the 2 days leading before, when I was reminding them, you know, that this is what we were going to be doing, they warmed to it.
Texas Public Radio joined the students on their trash pickup mission. They wore Day-Glo safety jackets and carried long mechanical grabbers to pick up anything they saw. Students Angel Sanchez and Ariana Reyes later described what they found.
Well, some of the kind of things we find out here are large, you know, amounts of trash, you know, some alcohol bottles, and, you know, it's just terrible.
We found a shower head.
Students Asia Patterson and Mike Cardenas say it feels good to do something good for the environment.
It makes me feel good because I like helping our community.
I feel like fantastic just making a better place for someone else in this future generations.
The city's Transportation and Capital Improvements Department, or TCI, oversees the Adopt-a-Spot program. Nefi Garza, TCI Assistant Director, says it's easy for groups or organizations to join Adopt-a-Spot.
We provide them with safety vests, we provide them with bags, we provide them with information, including even sometimes we're able to give them shirts and things like that. And we even put up a sign, if you adopt a spot, we'll put up a sign saying, hey, this area is adopted.
City officials say private properties and public properties managed by the Texas Department of Transportation are ineligible for adoption. They also say groups should find a spot where there is a real need for a trash cleanup and to make sure it's safe to access. To learn more about Adopt a Spot, go to sanantonio.gov and type Adopt a Spot in the search box. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
You got your group?
Yeah.
Great. Here. Somebody, y'all hold the bag.
Let's go.
All right, I'll hold. Are y'all going to work together?
Yes.
Has to?
File under One Small Step for Chocolate Chips. More than 50 years after landing on the moon, astronauts have now successfully baked cookies in orbit. The Associated Press reports that the International Space Station astronauts cooked the first batch of space cookies last month using technology from Texas-based commercial space company Nanorax. The cookies took around 2 hours to bake and are the first food cooked in space from raw ingredients. Now, as to how the cookies taste, Truth is, nobody knows yet, but let's hope better than that space ice cream. The cookies are being held in a Houston area lab for now for additional safety testing. Yeah. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. We got a whole lot more ahead, so stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. This week has produced some long days for U.S. lawmakers in the nation's capital as Democratic House impeachment managers continue to lay out their case in the Senate impeachment trial against President Donald Trump. Texas Democratic Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia is one of those managers. And on the Republican side, Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe, named to President Trump's impeachment manager team. There are plenty of other Texans involved in this affair, and here to help us break down their roles in this impeachment drama is Todd Gilman. He is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It is always a pleasure.
So, quickly, what were the rules set by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier this week that caused some tension between Democrats and Republicans? Did this have to do with timing and that sort of thing, or something else?
Well, there was actually kind of bipartisan pushback on the timing. As we saw, the first session went 13 hours into 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. Nobody on either side really wanted to do that. And McConnell's initial rules would have allowed 24 hours of argument from the House managers, the prosecution, and 24 hours from the defense team. Each 24-hour period spread over two calendar days, which would have meant, 12 hours is not 12 hours. 12 hours is like 16 hours with the potty breaks and
dinner breaks.
And you've got senators who are 86. So everybody pushed back on that. They spread it over 3 days. So we're talking about 6 days worth of arguments now. The real rules friction had to do with the refusal of Republicans to give in to Democrats' demands to agree to call witnesses or to subpoena documents from the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department that would further illuminate the president's actions vis-a-vis Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Republicans insist that they will revisit this issue after the opening arguments are made. But Democrats also tried to put in an amendment saying that for sure the Senate commits to revisiting that issue once opening arguments remain. And even that was shot down on a pure party line vote, 53-47. This bodes very well for the president's acquittal because 53 Republicans are sticking together and you need 67 votes to convict and remove from office.
Texas Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia spent some time on the Senate floor yesterday laying her case out against the president. Did you think she brought something to the table?
She did. I think a lot of other people weren't quite sure what to expect. She is a freshman, and it was really an extraordinary choice for Speaker Pelosi to put her on this very small team of seven prosecutors, House managers. But her presentation on the substance was quite effective. Congressman Garcia's assignment was to talk about Rudy Giuliani and his efforts to prod Ukraine to do this very personal favor for the president to do a corruption probe of Joe Biden, announce that probe, and how Giuliani made no bones about the fact that he was acting in his capacity as the president's personal attorney. This really goes to the heart of the Democrats' case that whatever drug deal they were trying to cook up, as John Bolton called it, was a personal errand. It was not to further the American national security interest.
Okay, so Republican Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe is apparently, since he's part of the other side of this affair, he's going to be making some remarks on the Senate floor at some point. Any expectations there?
Well, we're pretty sure he's not going to speak on the Senate floor.
Ah.
His his role and the role of another half dozen House Republicans that the White House named to the defense team late Monday night, I guess it was, is to supplement Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, and Jay Sekulow, the president's personal attorney, and, mm-hmm. and some of the others, Alan Dershowitz, supplement them by being a resource. They were in the hearings. Radcliffe is one of the few congressmen on either in either party who is a member of both the Intelligence Committee, which did the impeachment inquiry, and the Judiciary Committee, which had a very short process and then approved the articles of impeachment. So Radcliffe has he's kind of a walking, talking encyclopedia of the facts, as are many others, but he can contribute that.
Prominent Texas role here in this impeachment drama. Todd Gilman is covering this as Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Todd, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Sure thing.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, and hear what Texans are talking about on this Thursday. What are you seeing?
Hi there, David. Well, Governor Greg Abbott, as I mentioned earlier, he has some interesting words for blue state transplants to Texas. Quote, Texas is the last bastion of opportunity. Don't blow it when you come here. The governor making these remarks on Fox Business from the economic conference in Davos, where I believe he still is. When asked about the continuing inflow of new people into the state, he started off by saying, first, my job every single day is to wake up and make sure that does not happen. The chance that these new transplants could turn Texas blue. The governor then added, they need to remember exactly why they're fleeing California, why they're fleeing Illinois, why they're fleeing New Jersey and New York. Do not bring with you the thing that's causing you to flee those states. Come to the land of freedom, he called it. Texas is the last bastion of opportunity. Don't blow it when you come here. Lots of reaction to this one on
you don't
Twitter.
Say.
Yes. User El Paso Liberty, he says, California is a beautiful state with great people, but Greg Abbott is wise to remind California expats, just like Cuban expats, why they are moving to a more economically free society. California is horrible for starting or running a business and riddled with bad taxes. Meanwhile, Diana tweets us that you mean to tell us that the man who's constantly recruiting big businesses to move to Texas from California is cranky that Californians are moving here? And the governor does, you know, travel quite extensively. He's actually on a junket right now, you could say, promoting Texas economic issues.
That's right.
Gray Ginter calls Abbott the incredible shrinking governor, a small man for such a big state. And Amanda Lorien takes umbrage with something that the governor said at the beginning of that interview. He adds that his job is to make sure that the state doesn't go blue. No, it isn't. Your job is to serve the citizens of Texas, wherever they originated from. So lots of controversy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this seems like a riff on something that I've been hearing for, I mean, gosh, 20 years or more. Don't California or Texas, right? I mean, this has been going on. It's not like the
didn't cook
the
it
inflow.
Up last night, no.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I don't know. It is interesting. I know where the sort of political point that Abbott is trying to make on Fox Business. It's Fox Business that he was on, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, on one hand, that he continues to tout the growth of these cities and businesses. But on the other hand, throwing out a little red meat there for the base, I guess you could say. Well, speaking of the governor, another tweet from the governor that's getting some traction. He tweeted, healthcare for Texas women just got a $350 million boost. I think we heard about this earlier. The Trump administration restored federal funding for Texas health care program for low-income women. Funding for the program was cut by the Obama administration because Texas kicked out Planned Parenthood. And yes, as we've been talking about, the Trump administration agreed to give that money over the next 5 years to Texas Healthy Women. That's that state family planning program that excluded Planned Parenthood. Lots of folks chiming in about that one, but as you can tell from the tunes, we're about out of time there, David.
Yeah, but of course the news continues over at texasstandard.org, and we'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us till then. I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.